Hi, my name is Sam Williams, and welcome to part 3 of episode number 125 of my sexy music podcast, Millennial Throwback Machine. Like to welcome all of you to the very first part 3 of episode number 125 of my sexy music podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and for those of you who are just now discovering this podcast, either on the Apple Podcast app, or in Stitcher, or in iHeartRadio, and Google Play Music, or on Spotify, and you're wondering, so what the heck is this? I'm just going to give you a brief description of what the show's all about. Okay, so I'm Sam Williams, and I'm a 25-year-old songwriter slash producer, but I'm also a sexy music fan slash expert slash nerd. Each week of this podcast, I take one song by one artist in the 60s, put the show in two parts. First part of the show, talk about my opinion of the song and why I think it's so good, or why I think it sucks, and do my own personal analysis on the arrangement of the song, which will include the chords, melody, and lyrics. And the second part of the show, dig deep into the history behind that track. In that part of the show, talk about who wrote the song, who produced it, who are the musicians in the track, whether it be the studio musicians or band members themselves, to see who the song was recorded at, and name that studio and where that studio is located at, and also the history behind the song, where they wrote the song, and producers produced it, and the artists that recorded it, and also the musicians that played on it, and the peak position of the song made up originally in the Billboard Hot 100 charts when it first came out, the Lekker label song was released on, where that label is located at, and the year and month the song was released. All that is in the second part of the show. Now, before we move on this week's episode of the podcast, I just wanted to say that this is a very, very special, edition of this podcast, which is not normal, because normally I do just two-part episodes and that's it. Part one being my take and my analysis and my breakdown of the song and then, you know, the history behind it, part two. That's normally how I do it. I mean, I try not to do more than two parts. But in this special instance where a couple weeks ago I did two songs in the same episode. I did the breakdown, analyzation, and talking about the song as far as the theoretical part of it, parts of it, and the arrangements of breaking down everything else about that. Since I did two songs of that same exact, thing in one episode, I decided that instead of trying to do the history behind both of the songs in the same episode, I was just going to split this up into a three-part episode of my podcast. And, part two being about the first song that I talk about, the history behind that. And I did that when I talked about She and Him. And part three, talk about the history behind this, the second song I did. And that song was a song by, the Crystals called He's Sure the Boy I Love. And even though it really was credited to the Crystals, it was actually recorded by our Darling Love and the Blossoms. And this week, I know this is a little bit late. And if you don't remember the song I did on Phil Spector when I dived into when I tried to break down, analyze the song's arrangement and review the song. When I did like She and Him and Phil Spector, I would, it's called He's Sure the Boy I Love. It was technically credited to the Crystals, even though it really was Darling Love and the Blossoms. You can find that in the couple episodes from now. I mean, actually, go back a couple episodes and you'll be able to hear the song again, just in case you don't remember it, because I know it's I'm dragging this on for a little bit longer than I normally do, but it's only because today I'm really going to get into the history behind Phil Spector. And look, I got to be honest with you. Phil Spector has probably one of the most in-depth careers out of any major record producer at that time. One that spanned so many decades. And more importantly, there's so much to his history and the people that he, encountered when in his days in the record business. And there's so much to talk about, with Phil. And be honest with you, I can easily do like a five-part episode. I can split this episode into five parts and do Phil Spector part one, Phil Spector part two, Phil Spector part three. But just for the sake of time, and also because I have so much other stuff I want to get into, on this podcast. I mean, I have so many other songs that I haven't covered yet that I want to cover, things I want to talk about that, you know, so just for the sake of time and making sure that, you know, I keep your guys' interest and I don't bore you, you know, I'm definitely going to stick to just this being a three-part episode and not just more than three parts. I don't want to do more than that, you know, so that's essentially what is going to happen. It's only going to be three parts. You know, part three this week is going to be all about the history behind Phil Spector. And look, you know, there's a lot of, when I talk about him, you have to keep in mind that there's going to be a lot of things about him that you might not be a fan of, because he is a very, very well-known producer in the record industry back, you know, in the late 50s and, you know, even in the 60s and or in the 70s too. But, you know, there's a lot of lore and a lot of stories behind him. And, you know, a lot of these stories are true. But the point I'm trying to make is that a lot of the stories that are well known about him are not, you know, stories that put him in a very good light. And, you know, and it's not, and it's, and it, and it's, and it, it really is because of just how insanely unpredictable and how just, you know, crazy and how just off the walls he was as a person in general. And, you know, in this podcast, I'm going to talk about sort of get into the origins of how he could have become someone like that. And look, I get that, you know, if you listen after listening to this podcast and you're like, wow, I hate Phil Spector, that guy was a total douchebag. I get it. I'll understand what you mean, because I mean, you know, just because he really was not a very nice person. he really just had a split personality disorder, and he was very, you know, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, almost. You know, just not, again, he probably had, you know, schizophrenia. He probably had bipolar disorder. I mean, he just had a lot of mental health problems. And just remember that, you know, even though he wasn't the nicest person in the world, and he absolutely probably deserved to go to jail, it's important to just separate that part of himself from the absolute pioneering genius he was as a record producer. And that's what I'm probably going to get into more of today, you know, and just, you know, talk about that part of himself, because the creativity of him being in the studio and him being, you know, a really skilled producer and being able to use a studio as an instrument and being able to talk to the musicians and the engineers and give direction on exactly what kind of sound he wanted. That was actually really, really cool. And that's something that, you know, he should probably be best remembered, you know, by as of right now. But also, you're also probably wondering, you know, what's going to happen with the next interview episode of my podcast. Well, to be honest with you, I did have two interview episodes or two potential people that I thought maybe could be really good people I could talk to in my podcast. One was a guitar player / arranger, played on a ton of hits for Cameo Parker Records in Philadelphia in the early 60s, and also did a lot of stuff in New York too. But he unfortunately declined to be a guest on my podcast. But what is still on the table is the bass player for Love and Spoonful, Steve Boone. He has, you know, he said he was interested in being a guest on my podcast, and I'm currently talking to him right now. So, you know, I feel like I'm pretty close to nailing him as a podcast, but again, I mean, as an interview, but again, I don't want to, you know, jump the gun and, you know, assume that he's going to be a guest, because there's a couple of things that he's trying to sort out right now. And, you know, but he's definitely interested. So, definitely, you know, keep praying for me that I'll get him as a guest on my podcast, because he's definitely interested. I just don't want to say that, I just don't want to officially confirm him as a guest right now, because, you know, there's still a couple of things that he's trying to iron out and do before he can officially commit to being guest on my podcast. But that is very exciting. And, also, you know, I have a very exciting update for you. And there's another thing I want to tell you guys, but I just can't right now, because again, I don't want to jump the gun and say that it's going to happen and then basically say that, you know, and have to tell you guys, oh, sorry, I jumped the gun and said and spoke too soon. I don't want to speak too soon. And I'm not, that's why I'm not going to talk about this yet with you guys, but it's very, very exciting. And it's the thing I've been telling you guys for a while now. And I'll just leave it at that. And I don't want to say any more because, again, I don't want to speak too soon, you know, before anything is officially locked in. But it's very, very exciting. I'll definitely keep you guys updated with that. But now let's get into the history behind Phil Spector and the Wall of Sound and that song, He Crystal Sure, the Boy I Love. And just a quick little FYI, this podcast might go on for quite a while. Because we got a lot to get through. I mean, we've got at least three decades to cover Phil Spector, you know, before, you know, we, you know, end this podcast. But just to start things out, you know, one thing, if there's ever one specific thing you're going to take away from Phil, regardless of all the terrible, awful things that he did and just how erratic and how uncontrollable and how unpredictable he was as a person and how controlling he was and how much of the fact that he was so off the rails and so just completely just a really shitty human being. Regardless of that, the thing you want to keep in mind, one thing you can take away from Phil, what exactly did he do that was, you know, what did he do that was different, that was not, that was unlike anything that had really been done before in the record industry in the late 50s and early 60s? Well, he pioneered a recording technique that everyone uses in today's record business right now. You know, every amateur, you know, home recording musician does this, and he was one of the very first people to do it before studios really were equipped and had the technology to be able to do this, and that was overdubbing. And basically what I mean by this is that I've talked this about this before on my podcast to, you know, to umph degree, but it's so true because, you know, in the late 50s, you know, and even to the early 60s, so many records were recorded live, you know, with little to no overdubs, meaning you would get a bunch of musicians together and record a song in the same room and you all be playing in the same room at the same time, and everything would be mixed and recorded live, and then that would be your record, and that would be the thing that would get shipped, that would be the tape that would get shipped, you know, to the mastering plants, you know, that would press the record onto a 45 RPM, and then next thing you know, the record is on, you know, is being sent to the DJs, and the DJs would play it on Top 40 radio, and the next thing you know, the song would be a hit, you know, and then obviously the record label would fund, the pay for all the expenses, and then would make the artist pay it back by, you know, selling a lot of records. But you know, again, like, that was very much industry standard at that time. But the thing that Phil Spector did that was a little bit different was that in his early days as a producer, he would do overdubbing in a sense that he would not do everything all live at the same time. He would do things one piece at a time in the sense that he would record one thing and then also record that and then add another thing on top and then another thing on top. And then basically this was all being done on very minimal 2-3 track equipment. And he would, you know, he would start with one specific section and then record another section and then another section. And then this was, and while this was happening, everything was being mixed and recorded. And, you know, he would listen to what he was playing back into, you know, the speakers, you know, and he would be in one room and then he would go into the next room and then he would go back and forth between the control room and himself in the studio, and he would basically be hearing himself, you know, overdubbing himself on for each instrument or each voice that he would layer onto each track. And then, you know, and basically the way they did this is that they had, you know, different tape machines going, two, three track tape machines going all at the same time. And this was way before people even realized, you know, this is way before we had Logic and Pro Tools and all this different, you know, technological equipment that we have right now to be able to do stuff like this very, very easily. Back then, you couldn't really do that. You know, this was back when the studios were not ready for this kind of technology yet. But he was doing that before people even realized, you know, this could be something that could be streamlined and something that could be more, something, a process that could be easier and something that everyone would eventually wind up doing, you know, at some point. But he was one of the first guys to do that. And, you know, and just to give you a little background on him, you know, his roots are mainly in Los Angeles, but, you know, he was born in New York City, and his mom was Bertha Spector. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, when Phil was a kid, you know, his whole life was tormented by the fact that he a lot of times couldn't make up his mind about certain things. And he just, you know, he had this way of, you know, being nice to certain people and winning their trust and then just betraying them and just totally turning their back against them and just being like, fuck you. I mean, that's basically what he was. I mean, that's, you know, when he was a kid, that's exactly the kind of behavior that he had. I mean, he was able to win friendships with people and then basically just give them the middle finger and be like, fuck you, man. I don't want to deal with you anymore. And that's exactly what he did. And this is what really messed things up for him further on into his life. You know, and why he did this, you know, I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that what was missing from his life was someone that could really, you know, educate him as far as what's right and what's wrong and core inner values that every person has when they come out of the womb and when they become kids. Because what happened was that Phil Spector's dad, Ben Spector, he killed himself in 1949 when Spector was only 10 years old. And this was, and, you know, and again, like this, a lot of family drama was happening at this time. And, you know, he killed himself. And then all of a sudden, Phil was missing a father figure, someone that could really, really hone in, you know, these very specific basic skills of just morality and basic just knowing what to do in certain situations, knowing what not to do in certain situations. I mean, you know, just he was that figure in his life was gone. And, you know, him and his mom argued all the time. And it was just very, very, you know, just very dramatic, you know, when he was a kid. And oftentimes he went to friends or he made friends, people that, you know, first thought he was cool. He thought it was really, really good. But then once they kind of got to know him a little bit and they saw like, ooh, what's this guy all about? He's a little, something about him is a little off. I mean, basically, you know, that's when they kind of turned his back against him. And this happened several different times in his career, but you know, he did spend his youth, you know, he was born in New York, but then he spent like his youth, like his teen years, his formative teen years were spent in LA. And, he went to Fairfax High School. And, you know, there, that's when he met a lot of people that would become movers and shakers within the music business in LA in the 50s. And these people included Jan Berry and Bruce Johnston and, Gary Paxton, Shel Tommy. I mean, all these different people that, you know, would later go on to do huge stuff in the record industry. I mean, Jerry Lieber, Mike Stoller. I mean, all these people were going to Fairfax High School. I think, you know, and also like, you know, Brian Wilson too. I mean, I think they went to Hawthorne High School. Actually, that's incorrect. They went to Hawthorne High School, but a lot of these people that, you know, that went to, I mean, Lou Adler, for instance, I'm pretty sure went to Fairfax High School, he might have been to a different high school. But anyways, I mean, they all kind of knew each other, and Phil Spector was getting to know a lot of these people in their youth when they were just, you know, a teenager, or, you know, basically becoming an early adult. And essentially what happened was, you know, Phil Spector became friends with a couple guys named Marshall Leap and Michael Spencer. And, you know, when he hooked up with these guys, he thought, you know, it would have been cool to maybe start a band with them. And, you know, one place that he really, really wanted to record at, but he just didn't really understand how the record business worked yet. He was still trying to just, you know, get his feet wet into being a songwriter and a musician. But he wanted to record this place so bad was Gold Star Studios. And Gold Star Studios was a studio owned by David Goldstein Ross, and Larry Levine was was the principal engineer at Gold Star at that time. And it was a studio located on Vine in Santa Monica in Hollywood. And, you know, he absolutely wanted to record there because he fell in love with the room and the studio and everything. But the fact of the matter is that he didn't really understand how the record business worked. So, you know, he would try to go in there and say, hey, want to record some songs? Well, kid, you got to pay like, you know, $15 an hour, you know, for studio time, or $6 for tape machines. You know, it's like, please just don't, like, if you want to record, you got to pay for it. And then I'm like, all right, well, ask my mom for money. And then basically, you know, he really tried to weasel his way into the record industry by just trying to get, you know, favors from other people to sort of further him along a little bit. But at the same time, you know, since he never really, paid people for these favors, he never really paid them back, you know, for all the things that he did that they did for him early on. That's when he was really starting to burn bridges with a lot of these people. And it's interesting because when this was happening, so he recorded with three guys, again, Marshall Leib and Michael Spencer and himself, Phil Spector. And they went in the studio to record the song called Don't Worry, My Little Pet. And it's interesting when they recorded this. So, you know, there were very few, if you listen to that song, there are very, very few musicians on it, actually. And it's funny because there's only three singers on it, but they're not all singing live under one microphone singing at the same time. Phil Spector actually had the singers layer their vocals onto the song. And this was all being done when, you know, Stan Ross was like, kid, are you kidding me? I can't do this. I mean, I've only got like two tracks. What do you mean? You want me to overdub like, you know, vocals on this? Man, this isn't going to work. Like, you can't do this. Like, we don't have this kind of technology in the studio yet. What are you talking about? And then basically, this is back when literally overdubbing was so much a thing of the future. And just no one ever thought, okay, like, we, you know, no one, there was no concept of it. At the time, there was no such thing as that, really. And, and Phil Spector just went in the studio and just overdubbed his own voices. And then he played guitars on the song. And for percussion or for the drums, he would actually, you know, tap on specific things, you know, in the studio, or specific ashtrays and cans, or specific, you know, he would tap on his legs too for percussion, you know, and that's what he would use as the drums for the song, because they didn't even have a drummer when they were recording the song. And then essentially what happened was that once they did this, Spector, you know, through his high school also met a girl named Carol Connors. Now, that's not her real name. She actually had a different name, but Carol Connors was the name that she would later on go by. And if you're wondering, okay, so why should I care about Carol Connors? Why would this interest me? Well, Carol Connors wrote a huge hit for the Ripcords called Hey Little Cobra. But more importantly, she actually co-wrote the theme for Rocky, which is a huge hit song that everybody knows. Literally, when you think of someone working out, like going on top of a stairwell, like, you know, running on a stairwell and just trying to really get into mood for working out, you think of Gonna Fly Now, which is the theme for Rocky. And essentially, she co-wrote that song. Yes, she did. She absolutely did. You know, and she and before, but even before any of that, she was a lead singer for this group that she was with Phil Spector. And again, there's two other guys, Marshall Lieb and Michael Spencer, and it was those three guys and also her as a lead singer, and they became known as the Teddy Bears. And what happened was that, you know, when they were recording Don't Worry My Little Pet, they realized that, okay, so this is a good enough single to release potentially, but we got to figure out how we're going to do that. And we got to figure out, okay, so what are we going to do for B-side? Well, you know, Phil Spector had written this song. He was kind of working on it. He was hashing it out. He wasn't really quite sure exactly whether or not this was going to be good enough to be released. But he had written the song, you know, on guitar about his dad and his, it was basically a tribute song to his dad, because on his dad's tombstone, you know, said this is basically his epitaph on his tombstone: to know him is to love him. And he decided to take that and essentially write a whole song about it. And essentially it was a tribute song for his dad, and basically he decided, okay, you know what, This could be pretty good. This could get used as a single. And the recording was very, very rough. In fact, I was reading that book, He's a Rebel, which is a great book, by the way, by Mark Grabowski about Phil Spector. And they were talking about having Sammy Nelson come in and play drums in the song. He couldn't, you know, and he couldn't really keep time. And, you know, they wound up having to replace him, you know. But it's fascinating because, again, like the musicians on the song were, you know, Phil Spector plus a couple of guys who would eventually wind up playing with him, you know, later on, actually. And it's interesting because, you know, when in Phil Spector in his formative youth, one thing that he wanted to do as a musician, that, you know, his mom was like, okay, if you want to do this, then I'm gonna give you all this stuff and make sure that you really, really want to, you know, have success with this. And that was, he wanted to be a jazz guitar player. And check this out. So, you know, he actually, you know, there's a couple of people that actually tried to give him guitar lessons, but, you know, the fact of the matter is that, you know, they just gave up because, again, Phil Spector had such an erratic sort of, you know, out of control personality that he just was very, very difficult to deal with. And a lot of people jumped ship from doing that. And those two musicians included Barney Kessel and Howard Roberts. And, you know, they tried to give Phil guitar lessons, but it just wasn't working because, again, like, he was just so weird. And it's just, you know, and basically that's exactly what happened when he was young. He wanted to be a jazz guitar player, but then he also kind of, people were trying to tell him, look, man, so jazz is on its way out. Rock and roll is coming up, and this is going to be the genre of music that people are going to be investing in. All the record labels are going to jump on this, and people are really going to, this is the kind of music that people are going to listen to and people are going to consume for a long time. And, you know, jazz is no longer going to be a popular entity. You can't even go out and play jazz, you know, and do jazz shows anymore. Like, that market is officially done. Rock and roll is coming up, and you got to jump on that. And he kind of realized that and decided, like, okay, maybe I should just stick with this rock and roll thing. And essentially, you know, when they recorded To Know Him Is To Love Him, by the way, it was at Gold Star Studios, and Larry Levine was engineer. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, one specific thing that Phil Spector loved about Gold Star was, you know, the echo chamber downstairs. And, you know, again, this was back when, you know, there was before digital reverb. So literally the echo chambers were this huge sort of downstairs empty sort of room where, you know, they would feed microphones into, and then the signal from, you know, the microphones coming through, you know, the cables onto the mics were getting fed back into the studio through the microphones that these singers are singing into, and the players are guitar players, and the people, the instruments are being played into that. You know, the signal was being fed from downstairs all the way up to the main room in the studio. And essentially, you know, Phil Spector, that was the one thing that he loved about Gold Star Studios, was that room. He really was, there was something about it that really, really attracted him. And he decided that, you know what, you know, I think this might be the place where I'm going to record all my hits. You know, this is home base for me. I love everything about the studio. I love the downstairs echo chambers. I love the size of it. It's not too big, and it's also not too small. It's the perfect size. I can really, really get a good sound out of here. And that's when he decided that, like, look, you know, this is going to be where I want to record. And it's funny because after they recorded "To Know Him Is to Love Him," he brought the tape. Actually, he got it to Lou Bedell. And Lou Bedell was a guy that, you know, had a stake in a label called Era Records. And Era Records was a label owned by Herb Newman, who also, you know, was cousins with Cy Warnker. And Cy Warnker was brother was Lenny Warnker. And, you know, all those, and Cy Warnker was, was Lenny Warnker later go on to, you know, do a lot of stuff, became one of the heads, one of the main producers and, you know, A&Rs at Warner Brothers. But Cy Warnker was basically one of the major label heads at Liberty Records. And Lou Bedell actually owned Dory Records, which is his own independent label. And through Dory Records is how "To Know Him Is to Love Him" got released as a single. And here, and one more interesting note about "To Know Him Is to Love Him." Another thing, this is another reason why, you know, Phil Spector was kind of pioneering, and this is something you probably didn't even think about until I just mentioned it. You know, there is this in popular music. Let's just forget about the 60s for a minute. In popular music, within the last 20, 30 years, and maybe even before that, maybe like, you know, 40 years, because this, you know, this is a very common thing that happened with popular music for, you know, the recent years. There is this chord progression that is very much industry standard, and it's one of the most recognizable chord progressions in the history of popular music, and it's basically a 1-5-6-4. And what I mean by that is that when you play a song and you play the chords C, G major, A minor, F, you know, it's everyone recognizes that chord, because I can, you know, for that chord progression, there's a million songs that go along with that one. And it's a very recognizable thing that everyone seems to know. And, you know, it's one of those things is that, but very few people know exactly where that chord progression came from. And, you know, and again, like, you know, music is the music itself has been around for ages. So I'm sure that, you know, it's that the origins of that chord progression go farther back than this song. But I want to bet money that "To Know Him Is to Love Him," if you go back and listen to that song, you'll notice that that chord progression is there. And that song was recorded and released in 1958. And if you go back and listen to that song, you'll notice you'll hear that 1-5-6-4 chord progression in there. And it's a very slow version of that chord progression. It's not super fast, but it's there. So if you think about it, not only was Phil Spector one of the very first guys to really experiment and do overdubs, even before, like, you know, there was, before you can really, studios were even equipped or allowed to even do such thing. You know, he also was one of the first songwriters to utilize that 1-5-6-4 chord progression, and also make and record a song with that chord progression, have that be a hit. And it's funny because some people be like, oh, wait a minute, didn't the Beatles record "Let It Be" with that chord progression? Well, guess what? That song is recorded in 1969, 1970. But that song, "To Know Him Is to Love Him," came out at least 11 years earlier. So, I mean, you know, that, you know, "To Know Him Is to Love Him" definitely predated "Let It Be" big time. You know, so that's something else to think about, you know. But yeah, I mean, just go back and listen to that song and you'll see what I mean. It's that chord progression that's so recognizable. So many huge hits from the 80s, 90s, and 2000s have it. Well, again, he was probably one of the first songwriters to write a huge hit song with that chord progression, just to kind of let you know that. Okay, so just a couple of things here. So Her real name is Annette Kleinbard, and I just found out that out through looking through my book, He's a Rebel, which was a really great book about Phil Spector's life, written by Mark Grabowski. And that drummer, his name was Sandy Nelson, but there was a typo in the book. It said it was Sammy Nelson. But yeah, his real name was Sandy Nelson. That was the guy that they tried to get to play on the record, but he was kind of bad. He couldn't really play in time that well, but you know, they were able to get, you know, a good enough take out of him just from doing that song. And yeah, so that song, again, it was released on Dory Records, which was Lou Bedell's label. And, you know, I think it was distributed by Era Records, which was owned by Herb Newman, who also had relationships with Cy Warnker, Liberty Records, and, you know, a couple of other people. But anyway, so that when that song came out in August of 58, it took a few months to get on the charts. By November, it was definitely in the charts of 1958. And it's funny because I think this was the time when Phil realized that he did not want to become an artist. He didn't want to be in the spotlight because, you know, he got offered to perform at Dick Clark's American Bandstand, and he got to do all that. But really, it was then that he just looked at this life of being an artist and being out in the world and said, "Look, this is not for me. I don't want to do this." And that's when he realized that, hey, I think I could probably be a lot better off if I'm a songwriter and a producer, non-artist myself. And that's when he realized maybe the money in the music business to be made is by writing songs and not being the artist. And that's when he realized that, because To Know Him Is to Love Him, he wrote that song and it became a huge top 10 record, which, you know, resulted in quite a big windfall as far as residuals is concerned from royalty payments per each, you know, song that, you know, for each hit record that, you know, he would write. So realizing this, he knew that in the late 50s, L.A. wasn't quite happening just yet. I mean, there were some smaller labels based in L.A., but at the time, it wasn't really quite ground zero for the music business yet, because, you know, people still thought that most of the hit records that were being recorded and released were being done in New York, because people thought L.A. was a place where all the big movie and TV scores were being recorded, and a lot of the big, that's where all the big movie soundtracks were being made. And a lot of the hit records, the small percentage of hit records that have been recorded in Los Angeles were, a lot of the times, these were records recorded by big-time movie and TV stars like Tab Hunter and Connie Stevens. So with that being said, Phil decided that it was time for him to leave Los Angeles. This was after he graduated from high school, right? This was in 1958, 59. And he decided, hey, I think it's time for me to go to New York, because that's where it's really happening. And when he was in New York, he met two guys that were also, like Phil Spector, were L.A. transplants. I'm pretty sure they went to the same high school as Phil Spector, and it was Fairfax High School, but they were much older than him, so they were out of high school by the time he was still in there. So they were studying at LACC, and they were basically LA, you know, songwriters and musicians. I mean, they grew up in the East Coast when they were younger, but by the time they were in their 20s, they were in Los Angeles. And they left L.A. for the same reasons Phil Spector kind of left L.A., because he realized that, you know, the scene in L.A. wasn't thriving as far as the music business was concerned. And really, you know, the place to be at for the music business at the time was New York City. So he met Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, who just became writers for a publishing company based, again, I'm going to talk about this again with you, in 1650 Broadway, which was known as, you know, Hill and Range, and it was on the corner of Broadway and 49th Street. And Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, you know, saw something in Phil that a lot of other people couldn't see, and that was a talent and eager ability to learn about the record business. Because let me put it to you this way, Phil Spector was still kind of a virgin when it came down to writing songs in the record industry and just how the whole thing worked. I mean, he was still kind of a newbie to this. So, you know, he needed a couple people to take him under his wing and show him the ropes in this part of this music industry. And, you know, Lieber and Stoller were the perfect people to do that for him. And when he was working under Phil Spector, the thing is that I really do think that Phil Spector learned how to become a producer from watching, you know, the drift, Lieber and Stoller producing the Drifters. Because I really think that when, you know, because at the time, that's what they were doing. They were producing the Coasters, and they were also producing the Drifters. And they were doing some stuff for Laverne Baker, too. But, you know, these guys were house producers for Atlantic Records, so they were doing a lot at the time. And, you know, these are also freelance guys. These guys didn't have to be just for one label. They could do things for other labels, too, like United Artists. So They were not in-house producers, and they were freelance guys, but at the time they were doing the most successful work as, you know, record producers for Atlantic Records. And essentially Phil Spector, his role in this was he was sort of their gopher and also their intern. And he was one of those guys that just watched, you know, Lieber and Stoller work as producers, and he learned quite a lot from them. And, you know, also at this time is when, you know, he met Doc Pomus and Mort Schumann, who were also on Sign of Songwriters for Hill and Range, because Lieber and Stoller produced a bunch of songs that Pomus and Schumann wrote. And basically also Phil Spector met Beverly Ross too. Now Beverly Ross was another one of those writers that worked in 1619 Broadway, and, you know, she became one of Phil Spector's, you know, closest, earliest close friends that he would ever have in the record industry. But like I said before, you know, Phil Spector's weirdness and erraticness really didn't serve him that well, because, you know, at the time, you know, there were certain record labels that, that essentially, didn't want to take a chance on Phil, really. They didn't really agree with his sort of unorthodox, you know, not normal aspects of recording, recording records. They took a chance on him, but once they saw how crazy he was in the studio, they didn't want to stick with him. And this happened when Ahmet Erdek and Jerry Wexler said, "Hey, you know what? Why don't you be a producer? Why don't you produce for records?" And that's exactly what he did, but he didn't produce any hits for Atlantic Records. I mean, he produced some records for, like, Laverne Baker, but, again, a lot of stuff that just didn't make it. But that didn't mean that Phil Spector didn't have any success as a producer in New York City, because in the early 60s, right, this was after he graduated from high school, he was in New York. There were a couple record labels that actually took a chance on him, and one of them was Dunes Records. Dunes Records, he became a producer for that label, and they're an independent label. They're not a major label at all, but through Dunes Records, he was able to produce two major top 40 hits, you know, in 1960, 1961. One was Carina Carina by Ray Peterson, and the other was Pretty Little Angel Lies by Curtis Lee. And when you listen to these songs, you're going to think to yourself, okay, these don't sound like Wall of Sound records. What's going on? Like, why don't they sound like, you know, the Ronettes and the Righteous Brothers and all those records? Well, this was really because at the time, Phil was separated. He was not working, recording at Gold Star Studios. He wasn't recording with the Wrecking Crew. He was recording in a completely different city with a completely different set of musicians and completely different studios. So because of this, you know, you couldn't really hear, the Wall of Sound wasn't really quite there yet. But the whole sense of recording in mono and also doing some layering was still kind of there, you know. But again, the sound wasn't there yet. And, because he was, again, separated from L.A. He wasn't in his home turf, which was Gold Star Studios in L.A. So he was in New York. And just to give you some sense of behind-the-scenes information about these songs, Carina Carina by Ray Peterson, it was an old blues song, first recorded, this probably wasn't the first recorded version, but the first commercially successful version was recorded by Big Joe Turner, and then basically it was basically redone in 60 by Ray Peterson. It was recorded at Bell Sound Studios in New York, and it was arranged by Robert Mercy. And Curtis Lee's Pretty Little Angel Lies was a song written by Tommy Boyce and Curtis Lee, and it was recorded at Mirror Sound Studios in New York. Now Bell Sound, I don't know if you remember this, was located on 237 West 54th Street, and Mirror Sound was located on 145 West 47th Street. And that's where Mirror Sound was located at. And essentially, that's where Pretty Little Angel Eyes was recorded. And I think Eddie Smith was engineer for Karina Karina, and for Pretty Little Angel Eyes, that was actually engineered by Bill McMeekin. And this is another interesting thing about Bill McMeekin, which I read in that other book I told you guys about, Studio Stories. But actually, this was in the He's a Rebel book too. I think it was in He's a Rebel. I don't think it was in Studio Stories. But Bill McMeekin was one of the first guys to actually isolate the kick drum on a drum kit and use that as a separate entity, and then just put a lot of compression on it and have that really stick out on a record. He was one of the first guys to ever do that, and that's kind of interesting thing about it. But those are the two big hits that, Phil Spector recorded for Dunes Records. And, if you listen to Pretty Little Angel Lies, you'll notice there's a big vocal group happening on that record. And even though they weren't initially credited, they were actually a doo-wop group called the Halos, which were one of those New York doo-wop groups, one of the hundreds of them, that wound up getting a lot of work as, session backup vocalists. And they're the same backup vocalists which are on another big hit that Phil Spector recorded for a different label. I think it was MusiCore. And that was for Gene Pitney, a song called Every Breath I Take, which is a Goffin and King song. And it's funny, Jerry Goffin told the story about how he was there when he recorded that session. And the atmosphere was so hectic and so weird and just so, like, you know, just definitely a little strange. And, because he was starting to build up his, this wall of sound recording technique. He was just beginning to do that. And that was another record recorded at Bell Sound Studios in New York, with Eddie Smith engineering the session. That was all 1960, 61, right? 60, 61 was when those songs were recorded. And at the time, Phil was definitely missing Gold Star Studios. He was missing that atmosphere being in that one studio. And he was just like, to be honest with you, I don't think the New York studio musicians liked Phil Spector at all. I think, for example, I was reading that story in that book I was telling you about. When Phil Spector wrote, had Charlie Macy play on a record, one of his records. And by the way, Charlie Macy was one of the greatest, New York session guitar players of that time. And he basically said, Charlie was like, look it, man, I can play whatever you want to, but you have to write it out. I can play whatever sort of part you want me to play, but I'm not going to play it unless you write it out for me. And Phil Spector got really, really mad at him because he didn't really know how to write out sheet music. He didn't really know how to articulate that and write things out as far as music notation was concerned. And, he got kind of mad. He's like, I don't know what you want me to play, man. Just play whatever you want. And then Charlie Macy didn't really agree with that, so he stormed out of the recording session. And this is one of the reasons why Phil Spector is like, okay, this New York really isn't working for me right now. I think I need to go back to L.A. And he figured this out pretty early on let me put it to you this way. Even when he was in New York, basically being an intern for Lieberman-Stoller. And by the way, he actually did co-write a song with Lieberman-Stoller, and that song was called Spanish Harlem. It was a big hit for Benny King in early 1961. It was before Stand By Me. And it's funny, and again, this is another reason why, and the interesting thing about Spanish Harlem is that it was written by Lieberman-Stoller and Phil Spector, but on the label was credited just Jerry Lieber and Phil Spector. Now the reason why this is because when Lieber and Stoller and Phil were presenting the song to the Atlantic record executives Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler, Mike played this very, very important part of the song on the piano, which is the dun 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 dun. He played that part on the piano when Lieber and himself and Phil were pitching the song to the Atlantic Records executives. But for a weird reason, again, I'm not sure why, but this is, again, a classic example of Phil being just totally unreasonable, totally not, sort of weird, very, very strange. Phil Spector did not want to share co-writing credit with both Lieber and Stoller. He didn't want to do that. So essentially, when you look up the writing credits for Spanish Harlem by Benny King, it lists as both Jerry Lieber and Phil Spector as the writers, but not Lieber and Stoller and Phil Spector. That's because he didn't want to share a co-writing credit with Mike Stoller. Again, I don't know why, but that's just how it happened. And, you know, so Mike Stoller did not, I don't think he earned any royalties on that song, but he did come up with a very important sort of marimba part in that song, which is crucial to that part for that part of the record. But anyways, like I was saying, you know, Phil Spector, even though he was his main area where he was doing most of his work was New York, he realized that, you know, this was not his favorite place to record music because he couldn't get the same sound that, you know, from these New York studios like Bell Sound and Mirror Sound. He couldn't get the exact same sound that he wanted that he could get from the room at Gold Star Studios in L.A. So realizing this, he decided to go back to Los Angeles. And now we're going to get into how did the wall of sound that everyone's familiar with Phil Spector developed? Because it kind of, again, started with Teddy Bear's Don't Worry My Little Pet, that those overdubs that he did. But when did he start working with the Wrecking Crew? Because he wasn't quite working with the Wrecking Crew just yet when he was recording with the Teddy Bears, even though Sandy Nelson was a drummer on that session. You know, when did he start working with the Wrecking Crew? And how did this go about? Well, I'm going to get into that with you guys in just a few minutes. Okay, so during this time in 1961, when Phil was really, really tempted to go back to Los Angeles, because like I just explained to you guys, he wasn't really quite happy with, you know, just the way he didn't really like New York recording studios that well. He didn't really get along that well with New York studio musicians. So he thought L.A. was where he needed to go back to. Well, before doing that, when Phil was in New York, he basically became acquainted with most of the Brill Building songwriters at that time. And this included Jerry Goffin and Carole King and Barry Mann, Cynthia Weil, and some other writers too, like Doc Pomus and Mort Schumann. They all met Phil Spector, and they realized how much of a powerhouse he would become in the music industry at that time. So what happened was that Phil Spector, what happened. So one of Phil Spector's very first hit records that he recorded in Los Angeles as a producer and not as a member of a band like the Teddy Bears, was a song called Love How You Love Me by the Pear Sisters. And that song was written by two Alden Music songwriters, Barry Mann and Larry Kolber. And what he did was that he went back to Gold Star Studios in 1961 and recorded the song. And this time it was, you know, he had Larry Levine being the engineer on the session. And I believe this was one of the very first times Phil Spector actually worked with the Wrecking Crew. But it's interesting because when he was doing this, the Wrecking Crew guys, which included Howard Roberts and Earl Palmer, and guys like that, and you know, the Barney Kessel. I mean, he included a lot of the same guys he would wind up using on, you know, the records that he used to record. You know, that he would wind up recording a couple of years later. When he recorded "I Love How You Love Me," he spent at least 3 hours, you know, working on the string arrangement for the song and mixing them, because the strings were actually overdubbed. They weren't recorded along with the rest of the basic track. You know, the strings on the song were produced by Hank Levine. Hank Levine actually did the arrangement for the song, and Phil Spector produced it. And, you know, he arranged the strings on the record, and the strings were overdubbed, but he literally spent 3 hours, working on the strings and mixing and making them sound, you know, okay. But it was just the same hectic atmosphere as the Spector sessions had when he was actually producing Twist and Shout, which he did an early version of Twist and Shout, by the way, by the Top Notes in 1961 before the Isley Brothers did it. And that was just as hectic and just as weird and just as unconventional as some of his other sessions were. But it's interesting because at this time, I really don't think a lot of other labels were really interested in becoming, you know, actually hiring Phil as their, you know, A&R guy/producer, because I didn't really agree with a lot of his weird sort of, you know, techniques as a producer. So what happened was that I Love How You Love Me was actually released on I think it was the guy, you know, on a guy's independent label named Greg Mark Records. And it did really, really well, you know, and then basically the label, you know, that song when it was released on Greg Mark did like made like top 10. So it did pretty well for itself in 1961. But then what happened was that that label was turned over to Phil Spector and a guy named Lester Sill. And Lester Sill and Phil Spector got together and decided, hey, you know what? Since no other label is taking a chance on me, I want to form my own label and produce stuff under my own label. So what happened was that he made up a business deal with a guy named Lester Sill, and they created a label called Phyllis Records, which I at first I thought it was Phillies Records, but it was actually called Phyllis Records. Well, Phyllis Records became Phil Spector's main record label. And they would become the label at the, you know, the Righteous Brothers released all their hits on, and, you know, the Crystals and the Ronettes. It was all on Phyllis Records. And, you know, a lot of the guys that he first worked with for I Love How You Love Me later go on to basically be the main guys he would use on a lot of those later records. But now that we're kind of getting into his early developments into the Wall of Sound, let's talk about the Crystals for a minute and how they kind of tie in with the He's Sure the Boy I Love, because this is when things kind of get complicated. So, you know, if you have any questions about this, just let me know. But this is definitely going to turn into a weird story that kind of ties in with just how, you know, not so conventional, not so great he was as a person, and how weird things got once he really started to become good as a producer. But let's talk about that for a minute. Okay, so what happened was this. The Crystals were a group that consisted of Barbara Alston, Mary Thomas, Dolores Lala Brooks, and Myrna Gerard, and Patricia Patsy Wright. And they were all basically, at the time, they were a group from Brooklyn. They were a group of young teenage black girls from Brooklyn. And they, you know, they were discovered by Phil Spector, and their very first single that they ever recorded at the time was a song called There's No Other Like My Baby, which is a song written by Phil Spector and Leroy Bates. And the song was cut at Mirror Sound Studios in 1961. And at the time, again, like, you know, Phil Spector was, you know, even though he felt like he wanted to be in L.A., he felt like he still had to prove to himself as being a really successful record producer, and he needed to really sort of sharpen in his tool shed as far as what he could do as a producer in New York, and he wasn't quite ready to be fully back in LA quite yet. So this is basically what happened. So he recorded the song at Mirror Sound Studios in 1961, and basically he used a group of New York studio musicians, including Richard Ziegler and Gary Chester on drums, and he used a lot of those guys. Wally Richardson, he used all Wally Richardson on guitar, Richard Ziegler on bass, and Gary Chester on drums. He used those guys on the session, and this is, I think this might have been his first official commercially successful music release on Phyllis Records, his new label he just formed with Lester Sill. And then what happened was that it was released in 1961, and it became a huge hit. Made the top 20 on Billboard. And then what happened was that this was in 1962 is when he actually started, and again he actually got together with them, and they recorded Uptown. Now Uptown was another song that that they recorded, you know, which was again the Crystals with, but at this time you know, it wasn't Barbara Alston singing lead, it was Lala Brooks. And Lala Brooks became the lead singer of the group for now. And essentially what happened was that she recorded it. And it was another song written by Alden Music songwriters Barry Manson and Thea Weil. You see, you know, after having spent a lot of time in New York City, Phil Spector, you know, basically became friends with Barry Manson and Thea Weil and Jerry Goffin and Carole King. But one thing that he did that I felt like maybe wasn't the best idea, but I feel like, you know, he wanted to be really in control with a lot of the stuff that he worked on, is that for a lot of the sessions that he produced, for a lot of the songs that, you know, he recorded by guys like Barry Manson and Thea Weil, he would often demand co-writing credit on a lot of these songs, even regardless of whether or not he actually worked on the song or not, he would often demand, like, he as demand himself as a co-writer, so that way he can earn more royalties off of the song if the song became a hit. And this happened many different times. You know, I mean, in fact, most of the songs that he produced, he'd often list himself as a co-writer, regardless of how much he came up with the songs or not. And this happened pretty early on. And one of the earliest examples of this is with Uptown by the Crystals. And then, you know, and it's interesting because, you know, with that particular song, again, it was another song recorded at Mirror Sound Studios in New York, you know, with Bill McMeekin engineering the song. And then basically the flamenco guitar and the strings, that was all overdubbed in L.A. at a different studio. But yeah, I mean, at this time, he was mainly kind of going back and forth between New York and L.A. He was thinking, okay, I'm starting to get honed in my craft as a producer in New York, but I really, really want to just stretch what I can do. And there's a lot of limitations of what I can do in New York, and I kind of wanted to get back to L.A. But the Crystals were a New York group, essentially. They didn't really have any interest in becoming a part of the L.A. scene until this very specific thing happened in 1962 that almost made them become a part of the L.A. scene, but really, that's not what they were a New York group, but they didn't want to go to L.A., but then this happened, and this was really when the ball started to get rolling for Phil, and this is the beginning of his wall of sound. It all started with this song. Okay, so this is what happened with Phil Spector. And once he kind of got into L.A., once he kind of had this wall of sound sort of thing developed. And by the way, he kind of, his whole idea about doubling and tripling instruments, which is a total thing that he actually did, it kind of got started earlier in 1962 with he actually recorded a song by the Crystals that it totally bombed, but it was very controversial at the time. It was called "He Hit Me and It Felt Like a Kiss." And he did a lot of this, the similar thing that he did with the Wrecking Crew guys in Los Angeles. He did a very similar thing in New York before this. He doubled and tripled almost all the instruments on the song. He did the exact same thing earlier in New York before he did it in L.A. in 1962 when he recorded "He's a Rebel." But how did this wound up happening is that he came back to L.A. in 1962, and what happened was that he actually, before he left, you know, L.A. to go, before he left New York to go to L.A., he actually met up with a guy named Aaron Schroeder around his own publishing company in New York. And Aaron Schroeder played him this demo of the song recorded by Gene Pitney, which I've actually heard before. And, you know, and Aaron Schroeder says, "Hey, man, so this is a really great song. I think you should go and record it." And, of course, you know, Aaron didn't tell him that Snuff Garrett on Liberty Records already had plans to record the song with Vicky Carr, and Phil didn't know this at the time. So I was like, okay, cool, I'll take this back to LA and I'll record it. And here's two things that kind of make the story a little complicated. Okay, so you know, Aaron Schroeder didn't tell Phil that Snuff Garrett had already plans to produce his record with Vicky Carr, and Phil quickly found out that, you know, Snuff Garrett was producing the song with Vicky Carr as producer, and it was basically slated to be her next single that was going to come out after her previous one. So, realizing this, Phil was like, okay, I need to get in the studio and record the song ASAP before Snuff Garrett releases it with Vicky Carr. So what happened was that he decided that he did not want to use the regular Crystals, because keep in mind, the Crystals were a New York band and they were not based in Los Angeles. But he was in L.A. at the time, and he realized that he didn't want to travel back to New York and bring him back to L.A. to record anything, you know, because he realized that, you know, why do that when he could just use a group of studio musicians here? And he owned the rights to their names, so he thought, okay, cool, why don't I just get this group called Darlene Love and the Blossoms, which consisted of Finita James and Edna Wright and Darlene Love, who, by the way, at the time was called Darlene Wright. And they decided, you know what, I'll just get this group to record "He's a Rebel" and not the Crystals, the actual Crystals. And that's exactly what happened. So In July of 1962, he enlisted a couple of guys that would become very, very important to developing his wall of sound. One of them was Steve Douglas, who did a lot to create, to basically form the wall of sound with Jay, with the three sax players, Nino Tempo, Jay Migliori, and Steve Douglas. And then Steve Douglas was the contractor for a lot of these sessions, so he knew all the Wrecking Crew guys, so he was the one who brought a lot of them in. Actually, so he brought in Hal Blaine as the drummer, and then he brought in Ray Pullman and, you know, on bass, and then he actually, so he used you know, Ray Pullman and Jimmy Bond and a couple other guy and Red Callender on bass, because at the time he wanted to use three bass players. So, you know, he brought in, and on this song it was just two, Ray Pullman and Jimmy Bond, but he also Steve Douglas also knew Barney Kessel and Howard Roberts and Tommy Tedesco, and those became the principal guitar players on Phil's sessions along with Bill Pittman. So he used Barney Kessel, Howard Roberts, Tommy Tedesco, and Bill Pittman on guitar, and then he would often have guys like Frank Capp playing percussion on the song, you know, and essentially, and Jack Nitzsche was a very important part of Phil Spector's sound, because even though Phil Spector had this entire vision of this whole entire just blur of just huge, you know, 100%, just not a whole lot of stereo separation, just 40, 50 takes of the same song, everything is kind of gelling together with the microphones being wide open. Jack Nitzsche did a lot to really sort of, you know, put two and two together and create that vision for him, along with Larry Levine, who was the principal engineer at Gold Star Studios. And this all kind of came together in 1962 in the summer of that year when they recorded He's a Rebel. And Al DeLore, you know, that's the other thing. So if you look at the key ingredients to Phil Spector's wall of sound, right, you've got the Barry saxophone, which is Steve Douglas, and then you've got, you know, Nino Tempo and, of course, Jay Migliori. But then you've also got the piano players. And the interesting thing about the piano players for Phil Spector's wall of sound, Andy's told me this too, they would all play different parts. They would never play the same part, right? But then basically, they would have three different piano players playing completely different parts, but it would all kind of sound to completely 100%, and they would create this entire full sound once they kind of got all together and played together at the same time. And that's kind of what happened with this song, because, you know, Al DeLore was the main piano player in the session, but on future dates they also used Leon Russell and Don Randy, you know, who also played on these Phil Spector sessions. So most of the time it was, you know, Don Randy, Leon Russell, and Al DeLore playing the pianos on the songs, and he would always use those three guys together. And then most of the time you had Earl Palmer and you know, Hal Blaine on drums. But the other thing to keep in mind about these Phil Spector sessions is that, you know, another thing that he did is that he actually used backup singers, but the backup singers he used were either people that were, it was either the Blossoms or it was people like Cher. Now, Cher was one of those really, really young girls, like 17, 18 years old when she was in L.A. at the time. And, you know, Cher became a backup singer on a lot of these records, too. And she's actually singing the backup in Sure the Boy I Love. And also, Sonny Bono, who was one of the main guys hanging out in Gold Star Studios at the time, he was also sort of an intern for Phil Spector. Now, at the time, you know, before that, Phil Spector was an intern for Lieber and Stoller, but now that he had his own, you know, had his own production crew with Sonny Bono and Nino Tempo and Jay Migliori and all those guys, you know, Sonny Bono became an intern for Phil Spector, and Sonny Bono actually learned how to produce from Phil. It's an absolute 100% true story. And yeah, so they got into Gold Star Studios in 1962 to record the song. And when it came out, right, in 1962, it was released under the name The Crystals, but Barbara Alston and Lalla Brooks and those girls, who I mentioned a few couple minutes earlier on this podcast, they're not on this song. It's actually Darling Love and the Blossoms. But what happened was that since Phil Spector owned the name The Crystals, he decided to, you know, release the song under The Crystals' name, but The Crystals aren't singing on this song at all. In fact, they were very upset and pissed off when they found out that this record was released under their name, even though they weren't singing on it. And they actually had the Darling Love and the Blossoms singing on it. And Darlin' Love was also very mad and upset that she was never given credit for singing lead on He's a Rebel, and so neither were his girl were Girls of Blossoms. So, and you would think that after this little incident that happened, you know, Phil Spector would kind of learn from that mistake and actually credit the Blossoms and Darlin' Love for the next single, which was You Sure the Boy I Love. But what happened was that that didn't happen. And for the next single, You Sure the Boy I Love, which again, all recorded at the same studio, Gold Star Studios, in LA, with Larry Levine engineering the session, Jack Nitzsche arranging it, and you know, Steve Douglas being the contractor for the session, you would think that he would fix it and actually credit Darlin' Love as the lead singer of the song, but nope, it was another song credited to the Crystals, even though the Crystals were not on the session at all. And this really didn't sit well with the Crystals, and it also didn't sit well with Darlin' Love, who was the actual lead singer on both He's a Rebel and Sure the Boy I Love. So when this happened, this is another example of sort of Phil Spector kind of turning his back on people and really not doing the right things when it comes to just making sure that things were correct. And he was kind of screwing people over, to be honest with you, and just not really treating them right at all. And, you know, it's funny because when Darlin' Love signed to Phil Spector's production team as a singer, you know, to his label, he kept her under lock and key for a very long time. And she was very upset that she really, that the group that was performing He's a Rebel on TV at the time, it wasn't her. And she was very upset that she really come out of the limelight and become her own artist for a very long time. And, you know, and then basically she got her big break when she got to appear on Jimmy Kimmel, Tonight Show with David Letterman, and she became a singer on there, you know. But before that, it was just very difficult for her to even make, you know, have a name for herself, because, you know, the Crystals were getting credited the songs that she actually sang on and the Crystals didn't sing on. So that's another thing about just how, you know, conniving, you know, Phil Spector was at the time. But now that we've kind of get into this whole wall of sound thing, let's talk about the actual production of what went on as far as the recording process for the wall of sound, and how did this come about? Okay, so like I mentioned before with previous episodes, like I've mentioned before in this episode of this podcast, the wall of sound was actually a direct result of not necessarily a whole lot of echo, but just the fact that there was no real sort of acoustic separation between each instrument, and each microphone was bleeding into each other as these doubled and tripled instruments played together. And the thing is that one thing I want to correct myself on something, because when I talked about this when I was talking about She and Him, I said that these were all recorded on 2-track tape machines. That's actually wrong. These songs are recorded on 3-track tape machines, and then recorded on more than one 3-track tape machine. That's another thing you have to keep in mind, is that since these tape machines only had 3 tracks, and by the way, they were Ampex, you know, 300 series tape machines, the ones that all the other major studios were using. So the thing to keep in mind is that once those 3 tracks were used up, they would use another tape machine to use up another 3 tracks. That way they could do more overdubbing. And it's funny because what would happen during these Phil Spector sessions is that he would have 6 guitar players and maybe 3 acoustics and 3 electrics playing together at the same time. And then he would overdub the bass players. And then he would overdub the, you know, and by the way, there were always 3 bass players, and then he would overdub 3 piano players, and then finally he would get to the drums and the percussion. Now, here's the thing about the percussion on a lot of these records. A lot of times they got very creative. So a lot of times they used snow chains, castanets, tambourines, gurus. I mean, they used a lot of different things, you know, and shakers. I mean, they've used a lot of different, you know, percussion instruments to sort of reamp the sound. But a lot of times that would be like the last thing that would get added onto the rhythm track. And then once Phil Spector had a complete rhythm track all together, and again, when they were recording these tracks, yes, they use a lot of downstairs reverb, from Gold Star Studios. But really, the sound of it was, like I said before, like they would do like 40, 50 takes of the same song and the same backing track, essentially. And then all the microphones were open, and there wasn't any, you know, acoustic separation between each instrument. You know, so everyone was playing together and the whole sound was blending together all in once. You know, and the microphones are wide open, and there was no, you know, studio, like acoustic sort of panels, you know, basically separating each instrument, everything was all blending together into one big, fat, huge wall of sound, with of course, it being emphasized by Barry Saxon, of course, at piano. But again, like I said before, there are three different piano players playing three different parts. One guy would play the low part, you know, middle part, and then the high part. But the high part would always come out the most. You'd always hear the high part the best out of all three piano players. And that's essentially how the wall of sound came about. Now, here's another thing that Phil Spector did that was kind of interesting at the time. So, like I said before, and Annie actually told me about this too. When Phil Spector would record a track, right, he would essentially spend almost 90% of the time in the studio recording the basic backing track for the song. And then a couple days later, he would come in and overdub strings and then backup singers and the vocals. And again, all done in another three-track tape machine. So he would use two three-track tape machines when he was recording these songs. So he was doing a lot of overdubbing. And again, this was before it was cool to even do that. Like now it's so commonplace that everybody does it. Back then, people weren't really doing it that often. But he was doing it before a lot of other people were doing it. But anyways, as I was saying, so another interesting thing that Phil Spector did that is worth noting is that he wanted to make sure that the A side that he was recording was absolutely going to be the song that DJs were going to play, and it was going to be the hit single. So what he would do is that he would go into the studio, right, and spend 90% of his time laying down the backing track for the song. And then what would happen is that he would ask one of the guys in the band, you know, in the studio musician band, whether that be Tommy Tedesco or Leon Russell, Al DeLore, Bill Pittman, one of those guys, and says, look it. You know, we got some free. There's like 10 minutes left in the studio time, but I want to get an extra side in or an extra cut in, so that way it could be used as the B side. What do you guys want to do? Now normally, the way other producers worked is that they would oftentimes have another song planned for the B side, and that's what they would record during a 3-hour session. But this is not how Phil Spector sessions worked. He would oftentimes spend most of his time recording one specific track, right? But a lot of times he wouldn't even know what to do for a B side. It was like, what do you guys want to do? Like, you can do whatever the hell you want. And that's exactly what happened. So what he did is that a lot of times the B side to a lot of these Phil Spector sessions is that it was essentially it was a made up instrumental song, you know, originally written by one of the members of the Wrecking Crew. And that's exactly what happened. It was never a planned song. It was just a made up song for the B side. And essentially, that's exactly how Phil Spector sessions work. He would spend 90% of his time recording the A side, you know, backing track. And then another day he would overdub strings and backup singers and lead vocals. And then, when that session, towards the end of the session, right, when he already had the backing track he was satisfied with, he was happy with, what he would do is that he would have one of the guys in the session musician band, the Wrecking Crew, they would have him just make up something on the spot and create this super dumb throwaway B-side. And that's exactly what happened. A lot of the songs that he recorded were just these dumb, stupid instrumental songs that were, you know, so that way you pretty much guarantee that the DJs would absolutely play the A-side and not the B-side. And the DJs would never touch the B-side at all. And that's another interesting about how Phil Spector sessions work versus other producers. So that was essentially how Phil operated as a producer back in the 60s. Again, he did a lot of things that were very unconventional at the time, like, you know, doing all that overdubbing and, you know, creating a deliberately disposable, you know, song for the B side. And he sometimes got that wrong, because there was one example of this, like in 1965, when he was producing the Righteous Brothers and he was recording Unchained Melody. He thought that song was going to be a bomb, so he put it on the B side, but it turns out, you know, and he thought the A side, Hung on You, was going to be a hit, but really that wasn't the case, because Hung on You stalled and it didn't do anything, and Unchained Melody, the B side, became the hit. So, you know, and by the way, that's the same Unchained Melody song that was used in the movie Ghost and a bunch of other things. So, yeah, he produced that, and actually Bill Medley produced that. He didn't produce it, but his intention for that song was that it was going to be a B side, and, you know, they didn't think, you know, he didn't think that was going to be a hit, and he was wrong. And, you know, Phil Spector's definite peak years of success was when he also produced the Ronettes. And by the way, the Ronettes were a group that he produced, you know, which had hits like Be My Baby, Walk in the Rain, Do I Love You, and The Best Part of Breaking Up, and Baby, I Love You. And those are all recorded with, basically with Veronica Bennett, you know, who later changed her name to Ronnie Spector, and then her sister, and then another girl. And essentially, they became a trio, they became a trio, and then basically, there were another group that Phil Spector brought in, and they were originally on a different label. They were on the Screen Gems label, Coalplex. Yeah, I'm pretty sure the Ronettes were originally on Coalplex, but. You know, they went under a different name, and then Phil Spector bought their contract out of Coalplex, and then basically brought him to LA to be signed for Phillies, and then they changed the name to Ronettes after Veronica Bennett changed her name to Ronnie Spector. And by the way, Ronnie Spector became Phil Spector's wife. And that's where they recorded BMA Baby, all with, again, the same exact process. I mean, Phil Spector didn't really change exactly, you know, his process was the same for every single record that he produced. And it's funny because his process proved to be very successful. I mean, Be My Baby was a top 10 record, and so is You've Lost a Living Feeling by the Righteous Brothers. And he would repeat the same, he would do the same thing every single time with all of his sessions. And essentially, that's what made him such a successful producer, because he rarely veered off from the formula from this formula. He had huge hits with the Crystals, and again, a lot of times it was Darling Love the Blossoms, but sometimes the Crystals. The other thing is the Crystals, actually, he did bring them, the actual group. He brought them back to L.A. and had them sing on records. So it wasn't always Darling Love the Blossoms. Sometimes it actually was the Crystals, like on Did You Run Ron, that was Dolores Lyle Brooks, and then he Kiss Me Again, the Dolores Lyle Brooks. But if you think about it, if you wonder exactly how much of an influence Phil Spector had on other producers at the time, well, there was just one guy who was in this band that you probably know about. I guarantee you, you might not know about this group. I'm not quite sure, but they were called the Beach Boys, and Brian Wilson was a huge Phil Spector fan. In fact, he's well known to have said that "Don't Worry, Baby" "Be My Baby" is his all-time favorite song, and he listened to that song over 5,000 times, or somewhere around that number. He listened to that song over 1,000 times, and he wrote "Don't Worry, Baby" as a direct answer song to "Be My Baby." That's a true story. So he loved, the Wall of Sound. He worshipped Phil Spector, and a lot of his production abilities as a producer originally came from Phil. And so did Sonny Bono. Sonny Bono learned how to produce records from Phil, and they all use the same exact musicians known as the Wrecking Crew. And that's how much of an influence, Phil Spector had on other producers at the time. And, and it's funny because, he had his peak years of success, and then he didn't really do much for a while, because he recorded a whole song and spent like over $50,000-$75,000 on it. For Ike and Tina Turner, called River Deep Mountain High, but it bombed. It made top 10 in the UK, but in America, it tanked. I think it peaked at number 89 in America, and didn't really do very well at all. And he was thinking it was so much was going to be a hit, and then it just didn't do well. And after that, he kind of went into hiding and didn't really do anything for a long time. And then he came back when he somehow got the gig for producing, actually remixing, a lot of the tracks that were on the Beatles' very last album, Let It Be. And he became the guy who not only remixed the tracks off the album, but he also produced a lot of overdubs on that song that George Martin didn't do, actually. And a lot of people, there was a lot of controversy as to exactly, what was his role in the songs, and why was he even there to begin with, because a lot of people didn't think that, he should have been there in the begin with. But again, he was someone that was brought in to do overdubs and remixes for a lot of the songs off of the album before it came out. And yeah, so, and then he came back, with Sonny Charles and Checkmates and Black Pearl. Different studio, though, A&M Studios in Los Angeles, not Gold Star. And then also, different arranger Perry Bakken Jr., not Jack Nietzsche or Gene Page, and also, but the same, pretty much the same musicians, though. And, you know, again, like, you know, A&M Studios, so different engineer, but still that wall of sound thing that he got from Gold Star, who's also good at A&M Studios. And you know, I think, and also that song, you know, was written by Tony Wine and Earl Levine, different writers, but still the Brill Building still coming out from there. And, you know, and yeah, I mean, you know, it's, you know, people that worked closely with Phil, again, like, you know, some of them thought he was a really great guy. Some of them thought he was really cool. But then others thought he wasn't the greatest, you know, and other people, you know, really got the chance to see the whole dark side of Phil, like Ronnie Spector. Like there was a certain side to him that just people didn't really see in the studio. But, you know, but eventually people did get around to seeing it, like with John Lennon and Yoko Ono. And there's hundreds of stories about, you know, basically Phil pulling a gun on John Lennon, because he actually did, you know, have guns inside the studio, and he oftentimes did, you know, use them on people, but he wouldn't try to shoot them. But he was definitely a hostile human being with a lot of mental health problems. And you know, and honestly, this, you know, and the other thing is that one little bit tidbit about Phil Spector I can give you that may not be as well known to the general public is that my friend who I've interviewed on my podcast, Andy Paley, he's told me that he actually introduced Phil Spector to the Ramones in the late 1970s. And what happened there is that, Phil Spector was at the Whiskey Go Go Club in the late 70s, watching the band Ramones. And Andy, you know, actually had a friend named Seymour Stein, who I believe was involved in the career of the Ramones at the time. And, you know, and Seymour, and basically, you know, since Andy knew Seymour and Seymour was involved with the career of the Ramones, Andy introduced Phil Spector to the Ramones with Seymour Stein, and therefore, they got together and they became, you know, a production team, you know, the Ramones with Phil Spector producing it. And it really all was because of my friend Andy Paley. And on top of that, they did a song for a movie called Rock and Roll High School, a song which is a remake of the Richie Valens song Come On Let's Go, done in that McCoy's Field. And I talked about that with Andy when I had him on my podcast. But so that's kind of cool. So that's an interesting sort of tidbit about Phil that may not be as well known to the general public, but, you know, Phil sort of erratic, sort of unpredictable, very, you know, dangerous personality eventually caught up to him because, as you know, as some of you might know, but some of you might not know, I think most people on here probably know this, but he was arrested for the murder for a girl named Lana Clarkson, and, he did go to jail for that, but, you know, it's just, he, again, like, you know, this is just something, he was always kind of like this, and, you know, it goes back as far as when he was a kid, when his father killed himself, and, you know, it just, and this really sort of, you know, sort of all off the, like, sort of unpredictable, very, you know, again, like, he definitely had bipolar disorder, so he had very, very, very bad mood swings, and just really, just, you know, he was very off the rails, even as early as when he was in with the Teddy Bears. So, again, like, try not to look at Phil as a person and more about the things that he did as a producer and the ground that he broke as a record producer back in the 60s, and how he kind of made being a record producer a well-known job, a well-known entity, because before him, people didn't even realize what a record producer did in the studio at the time. People didn't know exactly what a producer did. And he made the job of a record producer, the guy that brought the musicians in the studio together, paid for all the expenses, you know, and, you know, made sure that he was staying on budget and, you know, utilizing the studio as an instrument and creating his vision for the sound that he had in his head with the help of an engineer and arranger. I mean, people didn't realize exactly what a producer did in the studio at the time until Phil Spector came around. He was really one of the very first very famous record producers. I mean, you know, it's like a TV director or a movie producer. I mean, people really knew a Phil Spector record when they heard it, because it was definitely a Phil Spector production, you know. And, you know, it's not often you could say that with a lot of records from that time, because it's kind of hard, you know, unless you're a seasoned, you know, historian, it's like you can't always tell if it, you know, who's producing a song or not. But he had his own very own signature sound, and he developed it, And it became, you know, he put his own stamp on a lot of these Brill Building Pop sessions. And, you know, and essentially, you know, he knew a lot of them from his days in New York in the early 60s. And then he came back to L.A. and he, you know, and he and a lot of those writers came back to L.A. with him. And, you know, and he produced a lot of the records that they wrote in New, they wrote in New York, like Jeff Barry, Nellie Greenwich, and Barry Manson, The Wilds. So, you know, and this is, and again, like Phil Spector, he, as much of a volatile person he was, you know, at the time, he just, it's important to kind of separate, you know, the artist, you know, or the producer, or more or less the person who's creating the art versus the artist himself, the personality. And I know a lot of people can't really do that. And I get it if you're not one of those people that's very good at, you know, separating the artist from the person who did it. But for me, it's always been an easy thing to do that, because even when I find out something about someone, you know, I still like the art that they create, even though they may not be a perfect human being, you know. So that's just me, but I'm sure you're probably a little bit different. But that kind of wraps up Phil Spector for now. So that concludes part 3 of episode number 125. Of my 60 music podcast, the Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and if you stuck around to right now and you've been listening for this entire episode, thank you so much. Oh my God. Wow. I mean, you must have a lot of free time on your hands, but really, I mean, if you find out some really interesting, fascinating facts about Phil Spector, and let's just say you're kind of new to a lot of this music and you never don't really know too much about him, and you found out some really cool and interesting facts about them you didn't already know about this guy, then please email me at samltwilliatiCloud.com, or you can also reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies and check out more of my original music at samwilliamsmusic.net. Now, also, as per usual, like I say at every episode, please check out the official 2-song single I just put out. It's been out for a month now, so it's officially a month since the single's been out. The songs are Turquoise Apricot, She Said No. It's an A-side, B-side thing. It's under my new stage name, Sam L. Williams. You can find all the streaming platforms, and you can check the link in the description of this episode of this podcast to find where you can stream it. I really appreciate that, and please let me know what you think of that single. I'd love it if you can give me some of your thoughts and opinions on that. And also, another thing you can check out is the official Spotify and YouTube playlist for this podcast. Here you'll be able to find all the songs I've talked about on my show so far, including some of the ones I've done in interview episodes. And if you like those songs, you think they're cool, and you want to suggest to me some more songs that I haven't done yet on my podcast that I think I should do next, please email me at samltwilliatiCloud.com. Or you can also reach out to me on Instagram, IROldies, and you can check out the official Red Bull merch store for this podcast. There you'll be able to find all this really cool merch that I that's specifically for this podcast, and includes my own official design for this podcast. It's the name of my podcast, and Keep On Truckin' Tie-Dye Font, it's a catchphrase I say at the very end of every episode, and Keep On Truckin' Tie-Dye Font, name of podcast on the bottom. I'd love if you guys could check that out. And you know, and also if you've liked the merch, you think it's cool, and you want to, and you would like to purchase anything, please let me know by emailing me at samltwilliatiCloud.com. But anyways, I actually have a really cool announcement for you guys before I end this podcast. While I was recording this, I just found out that Steve Boone, 11 Spoonful, is going to be the next guest on my podcast. Oh my God, I am really, really excited. Yes. So here's what's going to happen. Okay, so it's been a while since I've interviewed a guy from the 60s on my podcast. The last guy I did it was Mike Fail, the bass player for Tommy James the Shondells. So it's been a long time since I've talked to a guy, you know, who was an original 60s dude on my podcast. It's been a while. So I'm very, very excited to do this because I love the 11 Spoonful. They're just absolutely fantastic, great songs, really, really interesting sound, very, very different, and just not the same from a lot of other groups in that time. And it's the interview is going to be fantastic. We're going to get into the stories behind the songs, how they were written, plus the stories behind the groups that they were toured with on the road, and some of their opinions on them, and then the history behind the band. It's going to be great. Now, here's what you want to do. So I actually did 11 Spoonful on my podcast 3 years ago when I first started doing it, the first summer that I was doing this podcast. So Go ahead and listen to that those two episodes to get a little refresher on them, a little fresher on their memory. And also go listen to some of the songs. Some of the songs include Summer in the City, Do You Believe in Magic, Didn't Have to Be So Nice, Daydream, Did You Ever Have to Make Up Your Mind. Those are some of their hits, so go listen to those. But so that way you can kind of get an idea for the kind of stuff we're going to talk about. But I'm very, very excited to talk to them because, man, I love The Love and Spoonful. They're one of my all-time favorite bands, and I think you guys will like them too. And this should be a really good episode, you know, for you guys to listen to. If you've never heard Love and Spoonful before and you really want to learn more about them, because, man, they're so underrated. They're unbelievably good. A very interesting mix of folk, blues, and pop rock. And that's, I'm going to talk about how they kind of made that transition once I interview them on my podcast. But it's going to be so good. I can't wait to talk to him. He is an original member of the band. He was there from the very beginning of first hit record to the very last album they did. Super, super stoked to get to talk to him. I mean, I'm really, really excited to get to talk to him about some of his favorite songs that he, you know, wrote with the, wrote with John Sebastian, because he wrote a lot of these songs too. He didn't just play bass. He co-wrote a lot of these songs with John Sebastian. He played keys on a lot of these songs. He was really involved, you know, with the making of their records. I'm very, very excited to talk to him. So that's next week's episode. So this is going to be part three of episode 125, you know, with Phil Spector. And then the next week's episode is going to be an interview episode with Steve Boone. I'm so excited because it's been so long since I've talked to a 60s guy on my podcast. The last one I did was Mike Vale, and that was May, June of last year, so it's been a minute. So I'm really, really excited to get to talk to him. Really, really stoked. Okay, so that's what's going to happen with my podcast, and, you know, I'll keep you guys updated on the very exciting opportunity that I have coming up, and it's really, really cool. I can't wait to share more details about that with you as soon as I get them, but I'm very, very excited to talk about that with you guys, but... I'm Sam Williams, and thank you guys for joining me for this week's episode of my podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. Until next week, please! Keep things groovy.